Okay, so is everybody enjoying the code camp so far? Okay, awesome. All right, well, I'm Dane Morgridge. I'm one of the developers here out of Philly. You can reach me on email at dane@projectsandbox.com, on my blog at geeksofblogs.net/Dane Morgridge. You can get me on Twitter at Dane Morgridge. I also have a podcast that I'll talk about in just a second. The easiest way probably to get a hold of me is either email or Twitter. Twitter's probably the easiest and fastest. I'm on Twitter pretty much all day. And today we're going to talk about Real World Entity Framework. So first thing we want to do is, my mouse will work here. Yeah, this has been a live meeting. Okay, so these are obviously our sponsors for today. They're the ones that really made today possible. So just take your time and make the rounds and talk to them. They got some good stuff. But I do have a podcast, the Community Megaphone Podcast. It's kind of a little bit of a different podcast. We focus on community developers and, not some of the bigger names. Like, for instance, Joel in the back of the room was actually our second guest. So, and we decided to keep doing it after that. So, it's with myself and a guy by the name of Andrew Duffy. You might know Dev Hammer on Twitter. He's the developer evangelist down in Virginia. He's a pretty good guy, but we do this together, and it's been a lot of fun. We just recorded show 7. We're recording show 8 here in a couple weeks or next week. So it's been fun, but you should check it out. We talk to a lot of community developers and community speakers, so it's a lot of fun. So, all right, so let's jump right in. We're going to look at, first off, the history of data access in .NET. How many people here do data access in their code? Pretty much everybody. And that's true. There's very few applications that you're going to do these days that don't interface with a database at some point. So the first thing that I worked with in .NET was ADO.NET inline SQL. Just using regular ADO.NET with SQL connections and SQL commands. And then it was also data sets, which were cool. They had their place. And then it was also stored procedures. Now, up until version 2 of .NET, this was really the only option you had. So it was really taking what you did in VB6 or, anything classic ADO and just .NET-ifying it, basically. Except for data sets, of course, which were new. And then this thing comes on the scene called an ORM, or an Object Relational Mapping Tool. And basically what that does is it takes your objects that you want to work with as a developer and your database, which the DBAs have built, and meshes them together and allows you to work with the data in a way that makes sense to developers. Because a lot of times, DBAs, they want to normalize things a certain way. They want their database to be exactly the way it is. And it doesn't always make sense to us developers when we go to actually try to write the code against it. And we have to go through and, write the SQL statements. And this way we get objects to work with that's fit within our object-oriented development patterns. One of the first ones I ever worked with was called LVLGen. It's still really popular. Generates a lot of code, but it's a good tool. I've also used InHibernate. I'm sure probably everyone's here have heard of InHibernate. It's an open source tool, one of the most popular out there. I've also worked with Entity Spaces, and I haven't done a lot with Telerik Open Access ORM, but it's one of the newer ones, and it seems to be pretty cool. So let's look at Microsoft's history in ORM. It actually started in 2002, believe it or not. The first one was type datasets. And that shipped with Visual Studio 2002 in version 1. And it actually was an ORM. You may not think of it as an ORM, but if you ever did any, especially like any mobile data working with SQL Server CE, you could actually pull in the data and do everything through the data sets. It was kind of cool. Then it was this other product called Object Spaces, version 1, and that never shipped. It was something that it was an initiative they were working on. It was our first, outside of data sets, our first real ORM tool. But it never went anywhere. Then it was Object Spaces version 2, and that never shipped. Then we go on to this product called Microsoft Business Framework, which I didn't actually even hear of it. I got this information from a slide or from a video that I watched from one of the guys at Microsoft. I'll have the link later if you guys want to check out the whole thing. But there's Microsoft Business Framework, which I didn't even actually know about, and that never shipped. And it was WinFS, and we know where WinFS stands. And then finally, with Linked to SQL, shipped to Visual Studio 2008. Now, what's kind of interesting about Linked to SQL is Linked to SQL was actually a mistake. Not a mistake in as a sense that it should have never been built, but it was a mistake in the sense that it was never intended to be built. So what happened was the developers, I've got a nice blog post where I found the history on this. One of the guys working on the Link team said, well, you know what, Link is awesome, but we don't have anything to showcase it. And, you know, Link with its power, without anything to show developers, this is how you use it and this is its power, you know, it's going to be a hard sell. And so what they did was they basically started building as a sort of a prototype app, Link to Object Spaces. And it worked so well, they shipped it. So that's where Link to SQL came from. And then, of course, with 2008 Service Pack 1 and .NET 3.5, we get the Unity Framework version 1. And then shipping on Monday with Visual Studio 2010 is Unity Framework 4. Okay, so obviously you're going to be using some tools to build your applications. 2008 has Link to SQL, 2008 Service Pack 1 has EF1, and 2010 has EF4. There's also another cool tool called LinkPad. Does anybody use LinkPad in here? Yeah, a couple. It's a very awesome tool if you want to learn Link. There's a book, the C# 3.0 in a nutshell. There's about 3 chapters, and they're really good chapters on Link. And actually, all of the examples are in LinkPad. The guy that actually wrote the book wrote LinkPad. It's an excellent tool for learning Link. If we have some time, I'll show it off. There's a free version that has fully functional, but you can also pay for IntelliSense. If you're going to use it a lot, I would recommend going ahead, and it's like around $50 or so. It's a really good tool. And there's another new tool on the scene that actually just went out of beta yesterday, and that's the Unity Framework Profiler by Andy Raheen. He's one of the big guys behind InHibernate, wrote a profiler for InHibernate. There's one for Link to SQL. The Unity Framework Profiler will actually show you all the queries that are going through. It's actually, in my opinion, it's better than SQL Profiler because you can see the SQL queries in Profiler, but for the Unity Framework Profiler, you actually get to see the context that's created. You can see where the calls are happening, how long they take. There's a lot of, along with the SQL and everything as well. So the EF Profiler is definitely an awesome tool. If you're going to do a lot of work with EF, I highly recommend it. Okay, so a little bit about Link to SQL. I'm just going to jump through these a little bit. It was released with 3.5. It uses Link for data queries. How many people were in the last session? Okay, a couple of you. I don't know how much you went into this, but I know we went into the EF stuff a little bit more. But it only works with Link with SQL Server, so that is one of the limitations of the Link to SQL. And the database model must resemble the database schema. And this is pretty much you've got a table per table, object to object mapping, and you really can't do much outside of that with Link to SQL. It works really well for simple schemas or ones that won't be changing often. This is really a tooling issue. With Link to SQL, if you need to change your table, you have to actually delete it and redrag it over, and it can be a bit, you know, of a pain point if you're doing a lot of changes. But the rumors of its death have been greatly exaggerated. There's talk to people, you know, on the inside, and it's not going away. There's actually minor changes to its in Visual Studio 2010. However, in any framework is Microsoft's path going forward. So a little bit about Unity Framework 1. It was released with 3.5 Service Pack 1. Now it uses Link or Unity SQL for queries. So you can use Link to do the queries, or you can do something called Unity SQL, which is very similar to T-SQL, but it's actually against the model and not the database. So you don't have to worry about things like SQL injection and things like that, because it's only querying the model, not the actual database directly. It works with multiple data providers, so anyone who has written a provider for Unity Framework will work with it. I've personally used SQL Server, SQL Server CE. I've used the MySQL provider. They all work very well. But it is up to the individual provider. So if you wanted to write an Unity framework to a flat file, you could certainly do that. You would just have to write all the provider code yourself. The data model can be different from the database schema. One of the cool things about Unity Framework is it supports the ability to break out your model a little bit differently than your database, but everything's still mapped through. I'm not really going to go on that today. It's sort of an edge case, I think, but it allows for inheritance and some other things. It's kind of cool. And it works well with complex schemas, and updates are easy. Once again, this is a tooling issue. With Unity Framework, if you need to update your database, you right-click on the model and update database, and it does it. And unless you start removing, like, you know, foreign keys and doing a bunch of little stuff, then, you know, little weird edge case type things, and you're pretty much good. I've had to delete my model and recreate it a couple times, but you know, for the most part, the updates just work. Okay, so EF4 itself will be released with .NET 4 once again on Monday. The version was changed to sync with .NET. A lot of people have asked me, why did we go to 1 from 4 or from 1 to 4? And it was Microsoft is simply trying to get the version synced with the versions of .NET. And, you know, I've heard people say that it was for, you know, other reasons, trying to make the product look more mature and things like that. But the official reason is that they're syncing with .NET. So some of the new features. We have this very very nice thing called persistence ignorance, and we do it through POCO objects. Now, what persistence ignorance is it allows the classes that you work with to not know anything about how they're being stored, and the classes that are working with those POCO classes don't know anything about that either. And we'll go into a little bit later in the session on why that's important. There's also T4 code generation. T4 has actually been there for the last few Visual Studio releases, but Visual Studio 2010 is really the one where you can really take better advantage of it. I'll show that off a little bit. But basically, T4 code generation is whenever you create a new project in Visual Studio, there's some generation that goes on, and that's an actual template, that engine that's in there. Lazy loading is new to 4.0. This is a feature that was in Link to SQL, not in version 1, but it's now back in version 4. And we'll actually talk about that in just a little bit, because it's one of those features that it's kind of cool, but I think it'll end up biting you most of the time. Then there's self-tracking entities. Now, self-tracking entities are part of POCO, and what's kind of cool about it is there's some additional properties that get set on the self-tracking entities. There's a separate template for it, so that you can send an entity, say, up to a Silverlight application, and then flag that entity as changed, and then pass it back, and the entity framework knows it's changed. If you were to do this, you know, by yourself, you would have to pass the entity up, and then you would have to bring it back. And once you brought it back, you have no idea if anything has changed. So you have to actually go do a data query and check fields and make sure everything is good. With this, you can flag it, and so you know right away, and it can cut down on database round trips. There's also model-first development, which is allows you to start from a blank model and basically create your database from there. It's actually how I do most of my development with Entity Framework. The modeling tools inside Visual Studio for creating models they work very well. You can do almost everything you need. If you need to go through and do like database constraints and some other things, you still have to do that directly in SQL. But yes. Well, the Entity Framework model that you get when you bring in a database, you can start from that model and it will generate a database from that. So you will get an install script that you can use to actually create your database. So as opposed to using like ERStudio or some other, you know, large expensive database modeling tool, you can actually do it inside Visual Studio. Previous to Visual Studio, I would just a lot of times just create a database diagram in SQL Management Studio and actually create my tables that way. But you can do it right inside Visual Studio now. And then of course there's code-only development. This is still in the CTP stage, so it's not fully supported yet in 4.0, but what that allows you to do is basically do POCO, but there's no actual EDMX file, so everything's straight code only. It gives you some additional options. Okay, so we're going to talk about real-world Entity Framework today. I've got a couple basics we'll go through, and I'm going to look at a few demo apps that can show you some scenarios you might run into. But some issues that are important to real apps, you know, not just Hello World, not just, you know, little weird things, is you need reliability and stability in an application. And I've been using Entity Framework since it first came out with 2008 Service Pack 1, and I have personally found it to be very reliable and very stable. There's a couple instances where I've actually had to go to a stored procedure for data, but that was really not so much Entity Framework as it was Link. And it's true with any ORM that your ORM tool will solve about 80% of your database problems, just on average, and then 20% of those are really not something you'd want to use an ORM for. And it's just the nature of ORMs. I mean, that's true in Hibernate, it's true really any ORM you want out there. You know, it's really easy to do CRUD application or CRUD code with ORMs. It takes a lot of your time down. I probably save 70% of my database development time just by using an ORM alone. Then there's support. It is a Microsoft product, so there is support, but there's the forums, there's blogs. You hit me up on Twitter. I'm actually talking to people just about on a daily basis on Twitter about EF. And testing and testability. How many people do unit testing? Yeah, quite a few. One of the big things that that I heard people talk about EF1 that they didn't like was the fact that it was very difficult to unit test. And that's one of the big differences in EF4 is because of the ability to do POCO, it makes it much easier to test, much easier to use a repository type pattern. And deployment is really easy. You don't have to run any crazy scripts or everything. Everything's built right into the assembly. It's very easy to use. One of the complaints that I have about other ORMs is there's a little more work involved. There's less, you know, sometimes some manual code, some other manual things that have to be written just to get it working so that you can do a basic query. Within any framework, you pull in your data model inside Visual Studio, and it just works. Yeah, I wouldn't really consider that drag and drop development, but it's a good tool that brings everything in for you. And it fits into existing development paradigms, but, you know, very similar like what I was talking about with the testing. It's because of the POCO, you can now use it within version control, dependency injection, TDD, and et cetera. And once again, you know, the reason that we use any framework ultimately breaks down to productivity. You know, like I said, I've you know, probably cut down 75% of my database development time simply by using an ORM, because I don't have to go in and I don't have to write those select statements. I don't have to write update statements. I don't have to write delete statements. And, you know, when you look at it, if you start, you know, writing a bunch of those yourself, they're a lot easier. They're a lot harder to test. If you make a change to your database, you have to go find all the scripts. Even if you have your own data layer, it's a little bit more difficult. By using an ORM and Indy Framework specifically, you make a change to your database, you're going to know real fast if you're going to have any problems, and it's pretty easy to fix. Okay, so let's jump into some code. All right, so the first thing I'm going to show you real quick, sort of intro. What I've got here is a basic console application. So to get started, I just want to add, let me make sure I pull that out. To get started, just want to add a data context. So we add a new item. And then we go to data. There's the ADO.NET Entity Data Model. Now we're going to be working with contact data. So change this to contact model. Add. Okay, now here's the options. You can either generate from the database or you can start with an empty model. If you want to do model first, yeah, you can start with the empty model. Now, note in Visual Studio 2008, the empty model really didn't do anything. You would give a model, you could actually even add stuff to it, but you really couldn't do anything with it. You couldn't save it down to the database or anything. You could technically go in and edit the EDMX file manually in the XML, but there's no fun in that. So I'm going to go and generate from an existing database. Okay, so the dialog we have here is going to show you all databases that you currently have set up. I actually just reinstalled Visual Studio, so I only have the couple. So in your Server Explorer, anything you already have set up there will show up. Now in here, you'll notice the connection string is a little bit different than what you would. All right. How did I get that? Got a zoom button on my mouse or something, apparently. There we go. All right, so again. Okay, so if you'll notice, this connection string here is much larger than what you would normally see. This part highlighted here is actually the normal ADO.NET connection string that you're used to seeing. The rest of it is all Indy Framework specific. So if we break it down, this first part, the contactmodel.csdl, is your actual conceptual model, which is what you see on the design surface. Then you have the MSL, which is what will map the conceptual down to the physical model. And then you have the SSDL here, which is the actual physical model. Now, there's files listed in the connection string, but you don't actually see these in your project. They're actually generated and embedded at runtime. So if you were to break apart your assembly, you would actually see the files in there. We want to go ahead and save it in the app config. Now, whatever you name this is going to be the name of your context. So you want to make sure it's something that makes sense. Okay, so it's going to go ahead and pull up what I have in the database. All right, we just have a address and a person table. Now, if you notice here, there's a couple options in version 4 that are not in version 1, and that's the option to pluralize or singularize the object names or to include foreign keys. We want to go ahead and just leave those. If we hit finish. All go ahead and... Okay, we'll see. So we see our model here. So we have a person that has a first name, last name, date of birth, and then we have an address with some data, and there's a one-to-many relationship between person and address. So to access a person's addresses, we just hit dot addresses and access an address as person. We just do address.person. And you can go through here, and there's lots of cool things in the model. We're just going to jump past this for a minute. If you want some more information on how, you know, some other stuff in the model, just see me afterwards. So where everything starts is with the object context. So everything really begins and ends and lives around the context as far as the database calls are done. The context really has everything. It has your connection, it has your commands, it has your readers. Basically your context is the interface to the database for your objects. It does the change tracking and everything for you. So let's go ahead and look at SQL. Sorry, I'm cleaned out. Okay, I did have a little bit in there. All right, so the first thing we want to do is we want to add an entity. Okay, keyboard's locking up on me. Let's set date of birth to date. Now. Okay, so this is basically how you just, you know, go ahead and create an object, and you can use the new object initializers and C#3 if you want, but this is a quick and dirty way to do it. Now, as it stands right now, if I were to run this, nothing would happen. I've just created an object that gets dropped in memory, and that's it. So to actually get it into the database, we have to add it to the context. So there's a couple ways you can do this. You can do add object. Now, if you notice from the IntelliSense here that it wants to take a string and then the actual entity, what you can do is you can actually pass in the entity set name there, or you can do people.add object, which is what I normally do. Or there's also a add to people, which will also accept it. Now, this on its own also won't actually put it in the database. This attaches it to the context so it can be worked with and stored in the context. We call DB save changes. We go back over to SQL Studio. /*. All right, so we're going to run this. You'll see that our database is blank. Now, if we run this real quick. And we go and execute this, and you see that we now have a person in the database. Yeah, it's any object currently within the context, and it does do that in transaction. So, basically, that question was, what's the scope? Anything that's part of this context, when you call save changes, it'll look at whatever state it's in, if it's been flagged as deleted, if it's been changed, if it's been added. It looks at all the objects that are currently inside that context and creates one database call to save everything. Static? No, I would never use a static context. Just this instance of the context here. So, moving on. Obviously, a person is not going to be completely without an address, so let's create an address object. Let's see. Yeah, I always do that. IntelliSense getting ahead of me there. There we go. Okay, so if you were to do this using standard ADO.NET, what you would have to do is you'd have to add a person, you'd have to create your do your in-search statement, and then you'd have to get back the ID, and then you'd have to write another in-search statement for the address to actually put the address in there. So all we have to do now is just addresses.add, pass in the object. And so what we're doing here is we're creating the new person, creating the new address, we're adding the address to the person, and we're adding the person to the context. So when this runs, we'll have a person and an address as part of the context. Just go ahead and change this to 2, just so you can see the difference. We're going to run this. And then we check our database, and now we have the second entity with the address, and everything's wired up. So, yes? Alright, so the question was, is there an add or update? It all happens within the save. No, it would still insert it. And the reason it inserts it is because I'm not specifying a key here. If I were to put a primary key that existed in the database, then it would update it. So that's a basic insert. So let's do a quick query. Probably clear it up for.
It doesn't matter the order.
Yeah, it doesn't matter the order. So because what happens is the context will look at everything inside that needs to be done, and it will figure out what order things need to be done in when it executes. And it does it all in a transaction too. So if I had put something invalid, some invalid data in for the address and tried to insert it, the person would never actually go in. It would just fail the entire call. So, all right. So let's do a real quick query. Yes. Yes. So the reason that the person was the address was automatically added was because if we look at our database, there actually is a foreign key on address for person ID, and that's actually represented here in the model by the one-to-many relationship. So it's because of that relationship that it went ahead and did that. So, all right. So let's go ahead and do a real quick query here. Okay, so basically what we're doing here is we've got a basic, simple query off of our context. We want all the people, and we just want to push it out to a list, and that's going to give us back. This is actually going to come back as an iQueryable. Well, actually, it's going to come back as a list. If we just did two people, it would come back as an iQueryable. But because we do a two list here, this is automatically going to get filled. We're going to look through it and write out the names. And you see here, that boom, they pop out. So we have one with an address, so let's go ahead and let's jump through those real quick. Oops. I love ReSharper as long as it's... All right, so try out the street. Okay. So now notice we just asked for the people and nothing else. So if we go ahead and run this, what you'll see is we got the people and the address, and that is because of lazy loading. And the problem with lazy loading is if I wanted to pass this object up to, say, a WCF service, the service wouldn't actually get the addresses because WCF, as cool as it is, doesn't keep a connection back to Entity Framework. So if I were to pass this up to Silverlight app, and I go to hit dot addresses, there's nothing going to be there because it can't go back through WCF and lazy load everything on its own. So there's two ways to actually do this. If we go ahead and you can turn lazy loading off per call. We're going to have some reasons we need to do that in just a little bit. So if we go ahead and turn this off, you'll see here that all we get is the two people. So there's really two options here outside of lazy loading. You can do a dot include, and pass in the addresses, and it will pull everything back. This is usually the method that I do. The other one is you could loop through each person and do person.addressesLoad. All right, so the difference between the two options here is when you do the call like this using the include, it gives one SQL statement, one trip to the database, and it pulls back all the data at one time. When you do the dot load, it's just like calling doing lazy loading, except you're explicitly calling it. So I would do this if I wasn't sure I was going to need the address for every person that I pulled back, because this is another data call. When you use lazy loading, when you hit the addresses, it says, okay, well, there's nothing there. It hasn't been loaded, so let me go to the database and see if there's anything there. So you're automatically going to have a database call there every time. So in this instance, we'd have one call here. If we use lazy loading, we'd have another call here. Using the load, we'd have one here. If we use the include, though, everything would happen here at once. Now, where this could potentially be a problem is if you do a lot of stuff and you're pulling back a lot of data, you're going to have a huge SQL call and you're going to pull back, a larger chunk of data. But at the same time, you have, smaller round trips to the database. There really is no one recommended way to do it over the other. It's really case by case, what's really going to work best for your application. However, if you are doing a service or MVC or anything like that where you're going to be using the data outside of the scope of the context, because you obviously you're not going to pass the context and everything up to the WCF service with it, then you need to make sure all your data is loaded before you do that. The easiest way is to do that include or dot load if you only want to pull certain parts back. Yes? Mm-hmm. Right, if lazy loading is enabled. Yeah, it'll pull it from the cache. So. Okay, so the question was, what happens if you hit addresses again? It's going to pull from the cache. So if I were to do this call again and say in between there I actually added an address, but this context was still open, it's actually going to pull it from the context, from the cache inside the context. So you're actually not going to see that data refresh. And that's by design. The context itself contains everything that you need to actually do the query. So my recommendation is to do a new data context for every logical set of calls. So realistically, if you want different data to potentially be there at this time, then you're really going to probably need to wrap it in its own context and do things a little bit differently. The other option is, I believe if you called load again, it might load it. I actually haven't tried that, so I don't know if that would work. But it's also the reason why you don't want to use the context in a singleton. Because if you go through and you pull the data down, when you request that data again, it's going to use the cache first and not actually go back to the database. So, so the question was, is there any way to disable the caching? I'm not actually positive about that. I create a new context for every small set, so it's not something I've actually looked into, but that's a good question. I'm going to have to investigate that. So I can see a good blog post coming from that. So the question was, lots of small contexts, not a problem. I mean, if you're doing standard ADO.NET, you're probably not going to create one SQL connection, one SQL command, and one SQL reader that you're going to use inside all of your classes. You're going to create new objects whenever you need to actually do data access. And it's the same concept. It does connection pooling for you already behind the scenes, so you don't have to worry about that. Realistically, because of the caching especially, you don't really want to do you want to keep the context objects, very, very close. Plus, another reason you don't want to do too much, everything you add to that context, when you call save, it's going to evaluate every object inside that context to see what needs to be done. So if you're using it as singleton and you're doing a lot of data work, you could have a lot of objects sitting in that context that have not been touched, but the context still has to figure out if that's been changed, what needs to happen, and sends it to the database. So my recommendation is to do as little with each context as is logically possible to just keep issues like that from happening. So Because I've personally run into issues where I have a context, because I initially started doing it because all the examples I'd seen showed one context. And so I did that, and I queried some data, and I queried the same table but a little bit differently, and actually had a weird error come up because it was querying the same data, but because it was already in the context, but it was through a different query, it was just really kind of weird. So I would definitely stick with one context for, small amount of functions as possible. Okay, so real quick, we've shown how to insert, how to query. Now let's show how to update. So what we want to do for each person, so we'll just go ahead and set the date of birth to date time dot now. Let's go ahead and subtract 30 years. Oh, need to be inside my scope here. Okay, so what I did here is I reset the date of birth. Now, this object is already part of the context because I queried it, so all I have to do is make a change. I call save changes, and if I run this again, and we look at our database, you'll see now, I had debug and not execute. Okay, so you see now all the years are 1980. So it's very simple to just go in and make small, easy changes. So all you have to do is basically pull in the entity, make whatever changes you want, and call save. And Entity Framework will just figure it out. Deleting is as simple as db.delete object. And you just pass in a single object, and it'll delete it. Yes. Question?
Yeah, so then you updated the date of birth. So when it says the update, does it send a key where it says set date of birth equals and nothing else, or does it set the entire
So the question was, does it send up everything or just the fields that have changed? And it is just the fields that have changed. So if you were to look at the SQL, it would say, update date of birth equals, whatever, where that is, instead of updating every single row. So Yeah, SQL profiler is good, and then once again the Entity Framework profiler is better because it actually shows you everything in them. I'll show that off if I have time. It looks like I should. Alright, so that's real quick and dirty some basics on how to do EF. Now, you can get into some crazier, more advanced querying by, using Link. And I would recommend, if you don't know Link and you want to learn it, pick up the C# in a Nutshell book and grab LinkPad, because every example is in LinkPad exactly as it is in the book. It's very awesome for learning. All right, so let's go over and look at something a little bit more advanced. All right, so what I've got here, so I have an MVC application. All right, so if we go ahead and open up our model, you see here we have a few tables, but it's basically a customer, we have an order item, and then a product. And so what we've got is basically, it's just a basic MVC app that would do like a call center type ad. So if we go ahead and run this, I'll just run you through what it does. So this is going to pull up, we have a product list, create order, view order. So we're going to product list, and it basically spits out a list of Xbox games. We can do create order, gives us a big a little form here to actually do an order, and then we can also view orders that have already been placed. So did that just crash on me? Wonderful. It's the first time that has happened. I must have accidentally closed it. All right. Well, while that's loading up, here it goes. Everything I've showed you is in 1.0. The real big differences between real functional differences between 1.0 and 4 is you don't have foreign keys in version 1. So, like, if we look at if you look at this model here, you don't actually see it. So we have an order. This model was originally built using version 1. So if you look at the order, there's an order ID and there's a 1-to-many. Oh, wait, no, it is. Never mind. Sorry. I did re-import it, so it did show up. In version 1, this customer ID wouldn't actually be on the order. So you wouldn't have direct access to this. And there's the fact that there's no lazy loading. Those are really the two major functional issues that you'll run into between the two. But everything up until now works completely fine in version 1. Okay, so this app here, what we've got, so we go and look at, now I'm doing everything inside the app, this, or inside the code behind it, and this is obviously not the way you would normally do this, but just wanted to show the code. So what I've got here is I'm loading all the products, and I've got a real basic query. This is a longer version of how to do link. It does some data binding down to a grid. And that data binding is what produces the actual list. Now, if we look at the create order page, just like when I did the person and address, I've got multiple entities that have to get inserted at once. All right, so our save button here is going to loop through. I've got a function that just pulls out what the products were out of the page. So I create a customer, create an order. I set the customer equal to the customer property off of order. Now, I could have also done customer.orders.add, but here I went the reverse and added the customer to the order. And then I go through and create a new order item for each type. Now, if you notice here, I've got some code commented out. If you were using version 1, I couldn't just do order item.product ID. I would have to actually load the product in memory and then do product equals the product in memory. So you can see here, just by having the foreign key support, cuts down on some trips to the database. Then I add that to the collection, add the whole thing to the context, and it saves it, and then it just does everything. So go ahead and run this real quick. All right, so if we go to view orders, you can see here there's four in there right now. Sign up on one of those, and two of those. Create an order. It's going to go through. And okay, so when we're going through here, let's go ahead and just run past this breakpoint. You see that we now have another one. Now when I hit view, this is going to show me the singular order detail. Now, how I got all this data was this actually comes from a stored procedure. One of the questions I've had, especially with version 1, is, well, what about stored procedures? Version 1 does not have very good support for stored procedures at all. If you're going to be a lot of stored procedure support, I would probably stick with link to SQL for stored procedures if you can't move to EF4, because EF1 doesn't allow you to very easily create a stored procedure that's going to return back data. You can override the create or the insert, update, and delete statements with the stored procedure, but that's really all you can do with stored procedures in version 1. Version 4 actually gives you a fully typed result set. So if we close this down, go over to the view. So we go ahead and load in all the orders. Now, if you notice, I have, off of the context, I have a view orders function that returns an actual type of. So you see here we've got object result that view orders underscore result is actually a complex type that's created by the entity framework to match the result from your stored procedure. And then I just bind that over, and it actually behaves as a real entity. You just can't do any updates on it because it could potentially obviously come from different sources, and it's just a result set from a stored procedure. And then I just go through and I bind it to that, and then I take each order as it comes through off of the grid and go ahead and fill in that data. So that's sort of a more of a real-world type you know, how you would do any framework inside an application. Now, obviously, you're ultimately going to want to have your own data layer, and I would recommend using Entity Framework for your data access technology, but not for your data layer solely. And the reason for that is, you know, the reason you want to do a sort of a multi-tiered application so you have an actual data layer, and the reason you want to do persistence ignorance is if, you know, say you want, you know, you want to use Entity Framework 4 now, and then Entity Framework 5 has version or has changes that maybe for whatever reason are compliant or they don't work the same, or maybe you want to switch to another data access technology altogether, or you need to use another one right now and you want to switch to Entity Framework. When you have your data layer and everything's working through your layer, through that data layer in a persistence ignorance fashion, then all you have to do is change the data layer itself. You don't have to actually change the code. If you use the Entity Framework as your data layer, then you would have to actually go through and change anywhere where it's actually actually used. So for very small applications, you know, it's fine to go ahead and do inside, but, you know, you definitely do want to follow proper design patterns. So, all right, so let's go ahead. Let's pull up this. Now, what I've got here is a demo I put together for my Geek Speak on persistence ignorance. Now, I want to show you why persistence ignorance is so important. All right, so what I have is basically, let me show the code first. Maybe. Okay, so what I have here is actually I have three applications inside. We're going to look at the last four. And this is basically an MVC app that has a controller that spits out XML. And then each one of them, there's an actual data layer that has an EDMX file. And it also has just a little data admin class that basically just spits out the people to a list. So if we go ahead and run this, and we hit the people.xml. Now this is using real Entity Framework objects. So you can see I've got two people here. Now this is all the data that we actually care about. I mean, realistically, if you're passing this up to a serverlet application or any other code that's going to be using this, this is really all you care about. You've got your primary key, you've got all the data. But this entity key up here is all Entity Framework specific. And that all comes across and gets serialized when you're using standard Entity Framework objects. So what I've done is I've got a second one that has the same thing. It's the exact same MVC app, except the data layer uses POCO objects. Now, these are handcrafted. They don't actually use the T4 template. I'll show that off here in just a minute. Everything's completely written by hand. But if I go ahead and run this, you can see here the difference. Now let me go ahead and pull it up side by side. Where's the debug? There it is. Now, if we look at them next to each other, you can definitely see just in payload alone where persistence ignorance is better. Because what's getting passed over here is just the plain old CLR object that has just the data that you need and nothing else. So if you imagine you were passing off a lot more data, you're going to start running into a lot more issues with passing over bigger data. So, all right, let's go ahead and so how do you get persistence ignorance? Let's go back to the first one that we did. Now, if you notice, we started with an existing database, and these are real objects. So if you go into the designer file, and see here, if you look at the address object, it inherits from entity object. There's a lot of other things on it. So what you can do is you can right-click and hit Add Code Generation Item. And with the there's an add-on right now that'll give you this POCO template. So if we go ahead and add this, it's a T4 template. Now if we look at our generator file here, it's empty. There's just some comments and that's it. So if we go and look at each, there's two that get created, one for the context, one for the classes. So if we go into person now, you see this doesn't inherit from anything. It is partial, so you can add stuff to it very easily. But it's just, it's very easy, basic just properties here. Now, there is this fixed-up collection, and the only reason this is there, it's not tied to the Unity framework. It just, it helps make data binding and observable collections much easier inside WPF and Silverlight. So that actually comes in here through part of this other file. Now, if you need to add more than one model to your project and use the POCO context or the POCO templates, you're actually going to have this file duplicated. So you'll have to go through and remove that. But the beautiful thing is, we go ahead and run this. Still works. I completely changed the classes that we were using. I changed the context that we were using, and everything still works completely as is, so it makes it very easy to go back and forth between the two. All right, so the last demo I want to show you is Okay, so the question was, why would you ever want to use the original versions? The original Unity Framework objects. A few reasons behind that. There's some cool things you can do with the Unity Framework objects that you can't do with the POCO by default. For example, there's a on property change event automatically wired in. So if you want to tag an event to a certain entity for whenever the first name gets changed, there's actually an event that you can automatically subscribe to. The POCO, you can set an option to create a proxy class that will do almost everything that you need to. I generally stick with POCOs, I'm going to say probably 90% of the time. because, I would rather have the persistence ignorance class. Alright, so what I've got is I've got another application here. It's a Silverlight application that basically is going to pull data and drop it in a form. So if we go and I'll just show you what it when it runs here. Yeah, what this is it's basically there's a EDMX file, there's a WCF service, and a simple Silverlight application. If it loads, come on. Here we go. So basically the get data just goes to the service and it pulls back the data, which is the information that we just inserted. You can go ahead and click on it, and here it'll you can make changes and save it. But what I want to show you is the working with WCF and Entity Framework, there's a couple interesting things. For example, if we look at, if you notice here, I've got some options turned off. But go ahead and turn those back on. We run this. Now when I hit get data, you get a really weird exception. And when you're trying to dig through this, it's a little cryptic. So what it turns out the issue is, let's actually stop. Okay, so because lazy loading is enabled by default, so I spin up basically a list of people, and I push it out, and it goes through. Well, this call is going to serialize person. Well, because of lazy loading, when it gets to serialize the addresses collection, it goes, oh, well, there's no address here, so I'm going to go load it. And then on each address, it's going to say, oh, well, there's no person explicitly loaded to this address, so I'm going to load that. And so that's why you end up getting weird errors. So all you have to do is go in, turn off lazy loading, now everything simply works again. So let's go ahead and look at the other parts of it here. We've got one that'll just go get a single person, and then we also have a person. Now I've got a save function here I want to show you in just a minute. But so off of the service itself, we have a save. So I'm going to pass in an actual entity. Now if we look at the Silverlight side. Whenever I set the selection change, I have a person that's just out in the class that I can set to very easily and Don't laugh at my Silverlight skills, because now I would probably actually build a real lap as far as breaking it out. But so I go ahead and I select a person, then I bind that person to get the two text boxes filled. That has a two-way binding on it, so whenever those change, it updates this entity here. Now, right now, what's actually coming across the wire is a real Entity Framework class. So if you look at this, so we go in you can see here that we have the entity key, everything gets serialized. So this is actually a true Entity Framework object, it's just not it's not tied to a context anymore. So then what I've got is once the person's been changed and you hit the save button, it goes ahead and calls the save person, which is going to pass that person back in down through the service, which would get us to this function here. Now, the reason I went ahead and wrote the function this way is I pass in the actual object or the entity set name. Now, there's some other code out there that you can do to actually determine that on the fly and do, you know, a little more generic. But what I've got is this save method. It spins up a new context. You pass in the entity object. I go ahead and turn these off for the service reasons. But so I spin up a new entity key. Now everything in Entity Framework really revolves around the key and the actual objects to determine what's actually going to happen. So what happens is I pass in this create entity key. We'll take this entity because the person ID is already set here. So what it does is it looks for the actual entity key name and makes sure it looks for the property. I pass in the entity set name, and this function will actually take the model and say, okay, you know, the key for this entity is actually person ID, so we're going to go ahead and create the actual entity key property based on that person ID. And then I go through and I check to see if it's not zero, because I know obviously this time it's going to be an integer. And then I can just go ahead and pull the object in by the key, and then the apply current values will take the entity that I passed in with the and basically update it based on what's currently in the database, and then create the statement to only update what needs to be updated, and then call save changes. If this entity key happens to be zero, then I know it's a new object, and I can go ahead and add it, save it, do a refresh, and return the entity back if I want to. And so when I go in here and I run this, change that, hit save, changes here. And if we go back over to the database, everything changes here as well. So it makes it very easy to do Silverlight applications. Now, like I said, this was an actual true Entity Framework classes. So let's go back to it. Let's go ahead and make this POCO. So I right click and add code generation item. If you notice, we do have the classes here now. Now if I go ahead and build this, it builds fine. Now remember we turned off lazy loading. We go and run this. And we go to call the service, and we get a different error. So the error here is actually because... Oops, I relaunch it. On this here, I've got the proxy creation is enabled. Now what the proxy creation does, it's enabled by default. What it does is it actually creates a proxy object for your POCO object so that the context is still technically working with a real Entity Framework object, and it still allows you to do things like lazy loading and things like that. You're still using POCO. But because of using it with WCF, you have to turn the proxy off. And with the proxy off, lazy loading won't work, so you can leave that enabled or turn it off. It doesn't matter. So if we run this now, everything works. Let me actually change it. And then once again, all we had to do was just simply add the context. Now, the only time I've ever seen where you really had to make those changes is with WCF or any time you're going to serialize. You know, it really boils down to the lazy loading. with the regular objects, and that the proxies just get in the way. I think the serialization just doesn't know what to do with the proxy object, so you can just go ahead and turn it off. Now, you can turn it off at the context level or for each call, or you can actually go into the constructor of the context and go ahead and turn it off there. So here we have lazy loading is enabled by default. You can go ahead and change this here. However, if you change it here, it's going to get overwritten. So you could also go right into the template if you wanted to and make changes to the template if you knew you were always going to use it. If you're going to be doing a solid MVC application and nothing else, I would turn the proxy off or lazy loading off, depending on how you're going to do it, and just leave it off for everything. If you're going to be doing a mixed app that the data is going to be pulled from an actual regular application that's not using WCF and you're going to share some of that, then I would do it on a call-by-call basis. Doing it on a call-by-call basis is more code, but it just depends on if you need that flexibility. So here in the context T4 template, you can go through, where's the spot, instructors. So you can actually go through and you could put in the proxy, turn the proxy off here. Or you could technically even create your own constructor and pass in whether you want the wanted the proxy on or off as well. So that's that for code. Now let's go over and real quick look at LinkPad. All right, so basically what LinkPad has here, if you look at the samples, this has this is actually updated for version 4, so you can use this with, this is the current beta. So it actually has everything for the C-sharp 4, but the C-sharp 3, everything is still in here. And you can save queries and things like that. Like this is a this is an entity SQL query. It pops up. But now the biggest difference between entity SQL and link is the select comes first, but you have to have the value if you're going to pull back an entire entity. If you're going to pull back a subset in just certain columns, then you have to do it just a little bit differently. Like I said, entity SQL is something that I use when link doesn't work, but sort procedures are probably overkill. And there's probably maybe 2% of the times I have to do that. So let's go ahead and delete that. Now, what's really cool about LinkPad is you've got a couple options. You can hit link to SQL right off the bat, just pass it in database connection information to a data service. Or you can use a. Is it? Okay. You can use a context from an actual application. So let's go ahead and select Entity Framework. And if we browse through here, this is the first application that we built. Go ahead and open that up. You see here we've got our contact model. If you had multiple models in here, those would show up. You can select where you're wanting to attach to it, or by default use the information out of your app config. Go ahead and hit OK. You notice we have our information here. Now you always want to make sure that you select the context from here, because I half the time leave it as none. Run my first query and nothing happens, because I forget to actually select the context. Okay, so this is a basic link query. You have some options. You can do expressions, which don't require semicolons. You can do statements, which do. You can do entire programs, or you can do VB. You can look at actual SQL or do entity SQL. So if we go ahead and run this, you see here it goes ahead and it loads up all the data. You can see what's being pulled back here. Now this is, it's pulling back a lot because it's actually using lazy loading. So you can see how lazy loading, as it goes through, it generates quite a bit. If we look at the SQL for this, this is actually all the data calls that get done because of lazy loading. And then you can also go in and see the IL, which is kind of cool if you're into that kind of thing. But it's a very handy tool. I use this mostly when I have a query that's either not performing right or something weird is coming back. I can actually copy the query into LinkPad and make a couple small modifications to, you have to change the way the context is referenced, but I make those couple small modifications and you can debug the query and very easily in LinkPad and try to figure out what's going on. Then the other really cool tool is the InHibernate Profiler. So if I pull this up, this is an app here, and it's Actually, I'm still running an old beta. I haven't updated to any newest builds in a while. So what I've got here is a 2008 app that I'm wiring this in with. It does work in 4.0. I just don't have the current version I've got. It's not working in 4.0. So, but it's all you have to do is add a reference and then just tag this line in to initialize it. And if we go ahead and run this. This is just a real basic MVC app. That will load eventually. All right, so we go over to contacts. Now, if we look over at the profiler, basically the contacts page is going to load up the initial contacts that are in the database. So this shows you which contacts were actually called. So in let's see. I think that was actually loading it up from before. It'll show you all the calls, and I had this running before. I didn't know. I think I closed it, so it's got some old stuff in here as well. But it shows you basically where it came from, shows you the context, the actual SQL that was generated. So you can see here, although we're basically doing a select star, it's not actually doing that. You know, it can show you how many unique queries you had. It can show you queries by method. So it'll break down. And what's really handy about this over SQL Profiler is if you've got a lot of things going on, you can actually go in and look at your code and see what actual SQL is going to be created by method. You can do it by URL if it's a web app. You can see some overall usage stats. Ultimately, it's a very awesome tool because it shows you how long it takes to take back, how many rows that came back, and things like that. So now if I go in and I edit, see, there's no addresses, so I can go ahead and go ahead and save that. Then you can go in and look at the context call here. All right, so you can see here that it's doing a transaction, then it's doing the insert, which you can see everything that goes on here. And it's all parameterized, so you don't have to, it actually handles all the SQL injection for you. And so that's an insert, so we can actually go in. Actually, I don't have an edit on here. Probably should, but I don't. And then I can go in here and do the same thing. Actually, here's an edit, so I can go and change this to 6. Save. Now if we go back, look at this context. So here you can see it only, it did update everything because I repassed everything into the context. If I only actually updated in code the context, then it would only update the one. The reason it's updating all of them is because I reset them all. On the set in the property, it actually flags it as being changed. So the reason that they'd actually updated them was because of that, even though it didn't actually need to. So it's a really cool tool because it'll go through and show you pretty much everything that's going on inside in Hibernate. Now the really cool thing, or inside any framework. Now the really cool thing is if I close this, you know, it's not actually going to keep doing stuff. So, but that's a very handy application. All right, so let's jump back a couple more slides here. Just forget F5 does not do what I want it to. Okay, so some resources for Entity Framework. The first one is really the ADO.NET team blog. There's probably about 12 blogs all total. I'm not sure exactly how many. There's like an EF design blog, and there's different blogs that cover certain parts of the Indie framework. So depending on, you know, what you're interested in, but you can get at all of them from the ADO.NET team blog, and that'll show you some good information, some announcements and stuff. Another good one is Julie Lerman's blog. Now, Julie Lerman wrote the book Programming Entity Framework by O'Reilly, and in my opinion is definitely the best book out there. She's an awesome lady. I've spent some time chatting with her, spent time on IEM, you know, figuring out issues together, and I know she's helped me out, especially when I was just getting started, and she's got some really good stuff on there, especially if you want to get into like how to do a repository pattern with Entity Framework. She's got a 6-part series on her blog. It's really good if you want to check it out. Answer some questions, and here's my contact info. You know, once again, probably the easiest way to get a hold of me is by going either email or Twitter. Twitter being usually the easiest. And if you get a second, check out my podcast. So I think we got about 3 or 4 minutes. So do we have any other questions? It's Programming Entity Framework by Julie Lerman. This is the name of that book. Yeah, so the question was about modifying the model structure. Yeah, that's all done through the model surface, and you can do that in version 1 as well. But, yeah, I think it's kind of an edge case as far as doing, you know, anything crazy. And you can go in and change table names and stuff like that very easily. If you wanted to change the structure, you can do it all right through there. So, but... Mm-hmm. Okay, so the question was, can you basically switch database types? So could I go from SQL Server to DB2? And the answer is yes. If you look at the connection string, one of the other things in there was what provider you're using. So as long as your database schema, as long as your storage model matches up perfectly to the old one, then all you have to do is change that connection string, and it'll just work. So. Okay. Well, to actually push the schema back, the provider would have to have the model first portion. Because inside the provider, there's the data that basically tells Entity Framework how to generate the SQL. So that has to be there for each provider. So. Yeah, they actually have to have a provider for Entity Framework. So. Yeah. I also have a book